Hello and welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today we're going to be talking usury laws with economist Oren Rigby. These are laws that are against excessive interest rates. So he's going to be talking to us from Ben Gurion University in Israel. He's going to be telling us about some research that he conducted on usury laws. So we're going to start out by talking about the history of these laws, then about the debate on these laws, and we're going to be talking about his findings, which are that these laws don't work, and we have to be very careful about implementing them. So maybe after his conversation, we can have a little bit of a better idea where usury laws come from, and if they're not, if they are, or if they're not for the public good. So thanks so much for listening. Please stick around. I wanted to kind of lay the groundwork like you do in the paper. There's been references, as you say, to usury laws as far back as 1800 BC, and these laws have inspired great debate. As you do in the paper, can you let our listeners know what proponents and opponents of interest rate caps argue?
There's been a very long debate, and if you try to summarize the debate, I guess the main two arguments in favor of usury law are, first, that usury law will reduce the price of credit. And the reason is that usury law eliminates the market power of lenders, and by this, they just reduce the price that borrowers have to pay for their credit. In addition, another argument in favor of usury laws is that usury law prevents naive borrowers from agreeing to loan terms in which eventually they are going to default on. So the idea is that some borrowers are just not smart enough to figure out before they agree on the loan term that they just wouldn't be able to pay, let's say, this $300 or $400 a month. And then they manage to pay the first few months, but eventually they just default on the loan. So in that sense, usury law protects naive borrowers. So these are probably the main two arguments in favor of usury laws. And the main argument raised in the debate against usury law is that usury law prevents or reduce the access to credit from risky borrowers. And these are exactly the borrowers that usury law were originally supposed to protect. These are probably the main three arguments that they raised in this debate.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with Oren Rigby about usury laws. These laws against really high or excessive interest rates. We're just kind of reviewing some of the arguments for and against. The people who argue for these laws say it's going to reduce the interest rates because it kind of puts the reins on the lender. And then they also give an argument that people who like these laws say that it prevents the borrowers from making loans they would later regret, a paternalistic argument. And then the people who don't like these laws say that it reduces the access to credit for the one with the real low credit rating. They're not going to be able to get a loan because the lenders won't be able to charge the prices that reflect the risk. So please stick around. We're going to be talking a little bit more. This is the Logic Consortium. Professor, can you tell us how you studied this question?
Yeah. So first of all, the application that I used to study this question is prosto.com, which is a fairly new online person-to-person loan marketplace that operates now. Prosto operates in the U.S., but there are other similar markets that operate in other states. And the basic idea of Prosto and this person-to-person credit market is that it allows individual borrowers and lenders to interact and to originate loans between each other. And by this, they allow to cut the middlemen. So usually the banks take the role of being the middlemen. They connect between lenders who deposit their money in the bank, and they lend this money to a borrower. And in the process, the banks that the margin of the banks is usually around 10%. So they give lenders like 5-6%, let's say, and they lend the same and they lend this money for 15-16%. And the idea of this person-to-person credit market is just to cut this margin of the banks.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Oren Rigby about a recent study of his about usury laws, these laws against excessive interest rates. So he's telling us about how he went about this study, and the application that he used was a website called Prosper.com, where he was able to gather the data on who was accepted and who was denied for loans. Through that website, he was able to gather data which could tell him the effects of interest rates on whether a loan was funded, and whether these laws had effects on whether loans were funded and what price they were funded at. So thanks so much for listening. Please stick around.
So using data from Prosper.com, I find eventually, so my main findings are as follows. First of all, I find that indeed, usury laws, interest rate restriction, restrict the access to credit. And once you increase interest rate cap, you observe the largest increase in the access to credit, mainly for those borrowers who were almost funded under the original cap. And now, once you increase the cap, they are way below the new cap. Their market interest rate is way below the new cap. As a result, they have their access to credit is increased. So this result goes together with the argument that usury laws restrict the access to credit from the risky borrower. On the other hand, I find that conditional on the borrower characteristics. So, for example, you take one borrower and you observe what is the interest rate that this borrower pays under a cap of, let's say, 15%, and under a cap of, let's say, 36%. What you see is that the borrower is going to pay almost the same interest rate under these two different caps.
This is the Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Oren Rigby about usury laws. He's telling us that through his research that we've been talking about, he's found that these laws restrict the access to credit for the risky borrower and don't even really change the interest rate in which his loan is funded. So let's keep listening. Please stick around. Thanks so much. So Professor Rigby, you're saying that your findings really undercut a lot of the reasons for these laws.
Exactly. So this is just the idea that, I mean, if lenders in this marketplace would have had a substantial market power, then it might be the case that reducing the interest rate cap would reduce their market power, and as a result, the interest rate that borrower would pay would get down. But in this marketplace, we observe that there is hardly any change in the interest rate that borrowers pay, and this might be explained by the fact that in this market there is hardly any market power for lenders. So even the largest lender is fairly small in terms of its market share. Yeah, and in addition, another thing that I observe is that the default rate that you observe for lenders is more or less, so again, if you compare the same lender under a cap of 15% and then under a higher cap of, let's say, 30%, you observe that the lender receiving a loan, you observe that the lender has fairly the same probability to default on the loan.
So, Professor Rigby, what are some of the wrong assumptions that people are making who support these types of laws?
I think that the main difference, or in a sense, what might be the main driving force for this result of no changes in the price is the issue of market power of market power of lenders. So, in a it might be reasonable to expect that in a marketplace where you have only very few lenders, each one of them has a lot of market power, it might be the case that by reducing the interest rate cap, you might be able to decrease the price of credit. But in a marketplace where you don't have very powerful lenders, probably this is reducing the interest rate cap wouldn't reduce the price borrowers pay for their credit.
So these laws are don't work.
So I think they don't work. So I mean, probably one of the main takeaway points from this paper would be that you have to be very careful imposing these laws on the type or on the kind of the characteristic of the marketplace in which you impose them. So they don't, well, at least this is what I see in my application, that they don't deliver what they're supposed to deliver when you have a fairly competitive marketplace.
Professor Rigby, but okay, so these usury laws might not have the effect always that they're intended to, meaning that as your research has shown and you're telling us that sometimes they put people out of the credit market instead of really protecting consumers. So, but can't there be some type of laws against predatory lending? What about these payday loan places that you're seeing popping up everywhere that charge these exorbitant rates? Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I think that payday loans, in a sense, so I mean, at least in the beginning, I believe that all the industry of payday loans were not was not very competitive, and that and in that sense, there was a point in imposing interest rate restrictions on them. I think that once you believe that it becomes the market in which they operate become fairly competitive, probably the result of entry of new payday loans stores into the marketplace, I don't think it would do the work. On the other hand, there are many other aspects of payday loans, mainly the transparency and the information that lenders receive, and probably need to be regulated in order to allow borrowers to take smart decisions taking their loans.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and this is the music is by Scientific Map, and we're talking about payday loans, usury laws, government intervention into financial markets with economist Oren Rigby. Now we're going to be asking him a little bit about how this fits into the broader scope of hearing about government in financial markets. And we're going to be getting to bailouts and stimulus package and what he thinks about that. So thanks so much for listening here on the Logic Consortium. Please stick around. And thanks to Scientific Map for this Fear for Disappear. This in the broader scope of government intervention in markets?
So I think that, I guess that probably it is now clear after the last like 3 years from from 2007, it is clear that, I mean, there was a need for reform in the regulation of financial markets. And probably the main essence would be to make transaction more transparent and to allow the market participants to get all the information that they need. But I think that one of the things that, in my view, that the government or the regulator should be careful about is about regulating, it's like regulating markets which have now new a lot of innovation and are probably technology driven. So I'm referring specifically to the derivative markets or other markets with new instruments. And in that sense, you also can think on the person-to-person markets as some kind of a new innovation in financial markets or in credit markets. And I think that in regulating them, you have so in general, economists believe that innovation is good. Innovation is what takes your production frontier outwards, and it increases what you can do. So, you know, innovation is good, and I believe it is also good in financial markets, but we have to be very careful with innovation in financial markets. So probably a good thing to do would be if you have some kind of a new instrument, new tools, new technology in financial markets, it probably would be good to allow this technology to be operated in small scale, then study the, or observe what, how it influences how market participants react to this technology, and only then decide whether or whether and how you are going to regulate it. So, in general, what I'm trying to say is that innovation in innovation in financial markets as well as in other markets is not bad, and the regulator should be able. Or the regulator should try to allow market to innovate.
Professor Rigby, you were kind of just talking about how the government needs to be very careful in intervening into certain markets so not to stifle innovation, and that the government can get in there and put too much regulation and it would stop people from innovating. But what do you say about other types of government intervention like stimulus and bailouts and bailing out firms and trying to stimulate the economy?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of bailouts, so in general, I mean, it's clear that it was and it probably will be needed in the future. But you have to be very careful on the way you spend your money. So, I mean, one way that was, I think, that the government experimented with was just to send these checks to any household in the U.S. And essentially, it was clear that, I mean, this probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. So you have to think very well on exactly how you are going to spend this money. I guess another point in this issue was the too big to fail issue. So again, it might be problematic in some cases where you have firms or organizations which are very big. But on the other hand, you have to remember that sometimes there is an economics of scale. In that sense, in order to increase efficiency, you want to allow big firms to be formed in order to allow them to get advantage of economics of scale. So it wouldn't be always. So I guess what I'm trying to say in terms of the too big to fail is that, again, you have to be very very careful in how you are going to regulate markets in order not to have firms which are not too big, because you want to allow firms to enjoy economies of scale when there are such.
So you're basically saying that with stimulus and bailouts, you have to be very careful and be very smart about the money that you're spending.
Yes, I mean it is true that, I mean, stimulus was something that, I mean, it was a must at that point in time, and the only thing is to think carefully on how you are going to spend all these billions of dollars in order to really get the economy boost.
This is the Logic Consortium, and we're talking with economist and professor Oren Rigby from Ben-Gurion University in the Negev in Israel. And we're asking him about his studies of American usury laws, basically these laws that prohibit excessive interest rates. And then we're asking him about other areas of government intervention into financial markets and with bailouts and stimulus packages. So now, you know, because also, he also gives opinions on the other aspects of human behavior, we're going to be asking him a question about a recent paper of his asking in the U.S. if Hanukkah is responsive to Christmas.
I guess I mean, in this paper, I mean, the motivation for this paper was myself with my co-authors. We were all Israelis at that point in time. We all been to at Stanford, and the motivation was that in Israel, Hanukkah is not that important. It's definitely not one of the top three most important holidays. Whereas in the U.S., you see that, I mean, this is the holiday for Jews. So this was the motivation to try and to try to figure out why. I mean, what is the source for this difference? And whenever you ask any Jews in America, you get immediately the comment, the response that I mean, this is there is this difference because of Christmas. And what we try to do in this paper is just to demonstrate and to quantify exactly this effect. And basically, indeed, we find that those Jews who were who lived very close to very close in areas in which they have a lot of Christian, mainly actually Catholic Christian, these Jews increased their consumption of Jewish related items in the time around Hanukkah. So this was the main observation that we had from this paper.
Well, Professor, thanks so much for everything. Sorry, it was a little scatterbrained, but I really did enjoy the paper so much and learning more about usury laws, and I really thank you.
Dan, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
This is the Logic Consortium here on WOUW, and thanks so much for listening today. Today we were talking about economics of usury laws and government intervention into financial markets. He gave us a little bit of a taste of his paper on if Hanukkah is responsive to Christmas. Here on the Logic Consortium, we talk about any and all topics that have some type of effect on what's going on. So look us up at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. And send me an email. I am Briskovich, and if you want to bring up a topic, suggest a topic, or help debate or debate me about something, I'm more than willing. And thanks so much to The Scientific Map and Matt Hudson for allowing us to use this music. Hope everyone's doing well. Have a great day.